It's time for Culture Shocks with your host, Barry Lynn.
All right, welcome to today's edition of Culture Shocks. This is Barry Lynn. Later in this hour, we are going to talk about how one American religious community imploded with scandal, sexual and financial. But we're going to start on a somewhat more elevated note, and that is talking about God and the American presidency. And believe it or not, there have occasionally been presidents of the United States who don't think they are God. We're going to talk to Professor Niels Nielsen Jr. He is Professor Emeritus of Philosophy and Religious Thought down at Rice University in Houston, Texas, the author of the new book, God in the Obama Era. Professor, thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you.
Okay, this book talks about everybody from G.W., that would be George Washington, to G.W. Bush, and even on to Barack Obama, how they dealt with religion and ethics. Question, is there one president that you've studied who kind of got it right, the balance between not hiding the religious beliefs you have, but also not trying to put them out on the table just so that people notice and like you better? Has anybody done it?
I think our best model is one that Obama suggests, Abraham Lincoln.
Lincoln.
Who had a real sense of humility, was not playing God, and incidentally was never baptized or not a churchman. And I think Lincoln's humility, his tenacity, his courage, makes him, he sets the stage for so much that's best in American religion.
Some people say, however, not that they're necessarily critical when they say it, but that he also, President Lincoln, tended to create the beginnings of what we now call civil religion, that is, in speeches, his inaugural address, for example, referring to God, almost connecting God directly to the fate of the United States, which, of course, has been, whatever you think about the way Lincoln did it, it certainly was, shall we say, adjusted poorly by people, including George W. Bush.
Yeah, civil religion, I would say, the people who write about it, it's in the Founding Fathers, and Lincoln understood that it was there in the Founding Fathers. It's not ecclesiastical religion. It's the religion of the Enlightenment, God, freedom, and immortality. And Lincoln, on his way to Washington for the first time, spoke of the Americans as an almost chosen people.
An almost chosen people.
You know, he had the abolitionists on one side and the pro-slavery people on the other side, all yelling that God was with them and for them. And Lincoln was a shrewd enough and profound enough man to see it otherwise. How religious he was, that's a question, because Herndon, his law partner, said, "I never heard of any of this religion business." But I think Lincoln's religious insight and sensitivity was deepened by the fact that he was engaged in this awful civil war that cost 600,000 lives.
Yeah, it's a sobering whether you're traditionally or not so traditionally religious or spiritual. When you look further, there is one person I think most people, to the extent that could have answered the question I asked you, might have said, well, how about Jimmy Carter? I mean, here's a guy, he comes to Washington, he's the president, but he's still teaching Sunday school, not just when he goes home to play in Georgia, but here in Washington. The press used to go and try to listen to his Sunday school sermons or lessons for about 3 weeks, and then they decided, wow, they're just Sunday school lessons. He's not really trying to be political, and they stopped going. But was he a genuine balancer of religion as private, plus acknowledging that he was a public figure who talked about it, was comfortable talking about it?
Well, he got me interested in the question of presidents' religion because he started talking about new birth. That wasn't what most presidents had talked about. And before he knew it, he landed in the White House.
Born
I think
again,
Jimmy
again.
Carter's accomplishments were very great, with the exception of the Iran problem, But I don't think he'd thought through. He wasn't a lawyer like Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think Carter is still trying to apply individual ethics to the national scene. And I think Reinhold Niebuhr is right. There's moral man and immoral society. And in spite of the fact that Jimmy Carter read Niebuhr, I don't think he got all the way on that.
In other words, he was willing to say, look, I would do things this way, and therefore I guess the policy that I should be promoting would fall in line with that.
Yeah, of course, he had problems with Congress, even as the present incumbent has.
A few, yes.
Yeah.
Well, I remember Jimmy Carter saying once to someone I knew, he did, as you I'm sure recall, within the first week of office, he pardoned war resistors for the Vietnam War. And when he was asked to do even more and to do it in an even more sweeping fashion, he told this friend of mine who was working on the legal end of it, he said, you have to remember, though, I would have gone and fought in that war, so I'm different from them. In other words, he did personalize it, even though his policy kind of reflected what, you know, politically he had said he would do. But personally, I never got the sense he actually favored it. So that would fall right into your category of the individual versus, you know, the corporate thinking.
I think Carter is probably one of our, if not the greatest, one of the greatest ex-presidents. But what he did for civil rights, bringing it to the forefront, making it part of the American agenda, that he really believed in and was not pragmatic, and I think there he has to rate very high.
So that in your view, a Carter, when he makes these really profoundly important civil rights moves, in the back of his mind, is he saying, you know, God wants this, even if he doesn't articulate that in a message to Congress?
Oh, sure. That's there. The problem with Carter was, of course, that while he was negotiating with the Jews and the Arabs, the whole Iran thing blew up in his face. And that's very tragic for a man, I think, who was as dedicated and as... Carter was a brilliant man, no doubt about it.
Now, certainly was. And, you know, getting a kind of a belated credit for those good things as we get further and further away from the hostage crisis, which, of course, brought Ronald Reagan into office. Reagan was not a churchgoer, but I think the more we learn about him, we find out he was, you know, he read the Bible most days. I mean, he had a different kind of private religiosity.
Yeah, his minister says he spent hours singing and praying with Reagan.
No kidding.
I don't think Reagan did much that helped the country. That's too strong a statement. But when his opportunity came to make friends with Gorbachev, there the PR man came through, which puts him pretty high in the ranks of presidents.
Yeah, it certainly does. And you say there are very different kinds of religious expression, and how much the American people know about the expression of presidents' religion sometimes comes many, many years after. When we come back, I'm going to take a little break here, but we'll be back with Professor Niels Nielsen. He's the author of the book God in the Obama Era, Professor Emeritus, both of religion and philosophy down at Rice University in Houston. This is a very important issue because one, I've sometimes been told on this show and elsewhere, you know, if you really want to know about religion and how it affects public life, people in public life need to disclose what they believe. We want to hear more. Whether we like it or not, we want to hear more. So when we come back, we're going to take a look at this president, at Barack Obama. He is a Christian. He joked just recently, reminding people of that, because some people still say he's a Muslim and act like that would be a terrible thing. We're going to find out whether his public use of religion is a good thing or a bad thing. He has quoted Jesus more in the first year of his presidency than George Bush did in his entire presidency. We'll be back with Professor Nielsen in just a minute on Culture Shocks. All right, We are back right here on Culture Shocks. I'm Barry Lynn. Professor Niels Nielsen is my guest. He's the author of the new book, God in the Obama Era. He is Professor Emeritus of Philosophy and Religious Thought down at Rice University in Houston. So, Professor, when it comes to Barack Obama, he does talk about Jesus pretty openly. I have to tell you, I believe him. I always believed him when he said he was a spiritual man. I don't need to hear it anymore, and I'm still hearing it. Am I just being too critical?
Well, I think one of the strong points about Obama is he probably knows more about religion and the history of religion than any president we've had, with the possible exception of Bill Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
I think his mother's legacy is very strong there. She read Joseph Campbell. Joseph Campbell's a wonderful expositor of world religion.
Exactly.
And this is, I think, virtually the first time that we have someone in the White House with real sensitivity to Judaism. He did a Seder there. Or with the really living faith that exists in spite of all problems in Islam. I don't think his conversion was phony.
Yep.
I think he really understood what Christianity is saying. In his latest speech at the breakfast, he talks about grace, and he talks about faith. He's also read Reinhold Niebuhr.
Exactly. So he understands
this, I think, gives him an understanding of social ethics is different than individual ethics, and the problems of social ethics.
Where has he, in your judgment, correctly applied that difference? And where has he, in your view, taken a complex issue and made, in the broadest sense, a significant ethical decision and could explain it?
Well, you know, it's a really tough one. He's come with this terrible business of a recession, which he didn't generate, and now what to do about war in Afghanistan. And I think he really agonizes over that sincerely and is trying to think critically about a just war. But I think one of the effects, certainly, is that this man realizes that religion doesn't bring utopia.
Yeah.
And that we're going to live in a suffering world for a long time. He doesn't see it in terms of the black and white that characterized the Bush administration, and that we've had, at least from the Republican side, ever since Ronald Reagan. I think it gives him patience, and as he told a black church audience, you know, he can hold firm in difficulty. I think part of the man's significance is that he comes to Christianity from below and not from above. So many of our presidents, from Washington on to the Bushes, come at Christianity from above. This is a social worker's view.
Yeah.
And I think he really sweats the problems that he lives with. As a politician, he has to compromise.
Sure.
And,
but let me give you a specific example of the thing that that troubles me. During the beginnings of the health care debate, when he was, of course, and there's plenty of blame, I think, to go around about why that is in its current state of fiasco.
Yeah.
But he had hundreds, indeed thousands of us listening to a conference call that he did on health care. And he spent so much time trying to tell, this is the religious community of America, oh, by the way, we're not giving any health care to those illegal immigrants. And it just was, I found it shocking. This is an audience that in most cases wants to do something very positive about so-called illegal immigrants. And we certainly don't want to deny health care to the children of people who are here, whether they're here lawfully or not. I just found it so dissonant from a man who I had hoped really understood, at least at a moral level, that we have to be straight and say we have to do something about this group of people and their health.
Yeah, I think it's indefensible what he said, but I think the other half of it is the terrific pressure under which a man in the White House lives, and that he, to use a slang phrase, messes it up every so often. That's not surprising. I think when he runs his talk about faith-based groups and the things you pointed out about it, I think it would have been much better if, rather than the man who worked with him politically to get elected, if he's going to do that program at all,
yep,
then it ought to be in somebody else's hands.
Yeah, you were talking really about something our longtime listeners know a lot about, the faith-based initiative maintained out of the Bush years by the Obama administration. And the guy who runs the office was, in fact, his political outreach director during the campaign, 27-year-old Joshua Dubois.
Yeah, so, well, Bush tried a Ph.D. from Princeton.
Yes, he did.
You know, I mean, I think there's... it's just bound to happen in these kinds of things.
Is there always, Professor Nielsen, the lure of money from the side of the religious community? It's great. And when government comes, even when it comes with strings attached or what have you, there's a tendency to say, yeah, you know, I'm going to the trough too, along with the secular pigs.
Yeah, I think that the Jewish community and the Lutherans and, for all that matters, the Roman Catholics have learned more easily how to work around government policies and get grants that doesn't get them in trouble.
Right, right.
But I think I wish he'd come down a little harder on the separation of church and state, or a lot harder than the separation of church and state. It's not going to get us anywhere. And when Bush put that thing up and then couldn't get it through, he didn't really support it for funding in the budget.
Right.
So it's a tricky kind of thing. And I think what we want in America is a society which is open to all religions.
Yep.
And where Christian point of view is spoken for, but not from the point of view of the establishment.
Exactly. Not a favored status, and probably not the money that comes from all of the taxpayers, at least if these religious groups themselves are going to be able to discriminate, among other things, in the hiring of the people with that government money. Listen, Professor, I'm afraid we're out of time for this piece of the show, but I want to thank you very much. A lifetime of work in this field, Professor Niels Nielsen, Jr., Rice
well,
University.
Great speaking with you.
Terrific. Thank you so much. When we come back, a look at a sordid little tale of a religious community gone wrong. We'll be back on Culture Shocks.
All right, and welcome back to Culture Shocks. This is Barry Lynn. You know, we were talking with our last guest about some of the history and some of the controversies involving church and state in this country. Obviously, it's a huge issue for me, and I know for many of the listeners of this program. I wanted to talk for the rest of this show about a couple of things that are disturbing, that are going on there, that are not getting the mainstream media attention that they deserve. The first is, whatever happened to the George Bush-created faith-based initiative? Just a little bit of history here. During the campaign for the presidency, then-Senator and candidate Barack Obama told an audience in Zanesville, Ohio, that he'd be changing some of the constitutional defects in the so-called faith-based initiative that had been created by President George Bush. Here's what he said. Now, make no mistake, as someone who used to teach constitutional law, I believe deeply in the separation of church and state, but I don't believe this partnership will endanger that idea so long as we follow a few basic principles. First, if you get a federal grant, you can't use that grant money to proselytize to the people you help, and you can't discriminate against them or against the people you hire on the basis of their religion. Second, federal dollars that go directly to churches, temples, and mosques can only be used on secular programs, and will also ensure that taxpayer dollars only go to those programs that actually work. I mean, that's a trifecta, folks. That is three good things to change the direction of the Bush initiative. That is something he said before he was president. He's now been in office for over a year. He has recreated a faith-based initiative office at the White House, but nothing has changed. All of the problems of discrimination and of evangelizing with tax dollars are still going on. He left in place five executive orders, and in fact, one of those executive orders specifically allows any religious group that gets your tax dollars to discriminate and favor only its own kind when it comes to giving jobs to people with those tax dollars. In other words, you could take out an ad that said, no Jews, atheists, or Hindus need apply. We only take Christians here. And that would be perfectly permissible under the policies George Bush created and the ones sustained to this day by President Obama. People at religious organizations that get your money could refuse to hire you if you've ever had an abortion, if you're gay, if you won't sign a statement of belief in the inerrancy of the Bible. Is that wrong? Of course it is. Is it unconstitutional? Of course it is. Why didn't the president fix it? And is it that big a deal? It's a big deal because contained in that big stimulus package, the anniversary of which we have just celebrated also, are billions of dollars to be run through federal agencies as grants or contracts to provide social services to states and to private entities. Those agencies all have Bush-era rules allowing money to go to churches that discriminate. Well, what did the president do to look into this matter over the past year? He created the President's Advisory Council on Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships. Sounds like a big deal. It consists of 25 people, mainly religious figures, a couple of academics thrown in, and the idea was that they would advise the president on how to create a more lawful basis for this whole faith-based operation. Who's on this body? Well, let me tell you about a few of them. Pastor Frank Page, the former head of the Southern Baptist Convention, was a proud supporter of that recent resolution telling Baptist women they should be subservient to their husbands. When he was running, though, for the presidency of the Southern Baptist Convention, he was confronted with his own doctoral thesis in which he said that women should be eligible for all vocations in the ministry of the church. That was controversial. So he repudiated his own writing, noting that those words were merely the, quote, extreme views of a young seminarian. Who else is giving advice to the president? Richard Stearns of World Vision. You may have seen him on cable television recently down in Haiti. He does some good work for children around the world, but there's a darker side to World Vision. A well-respected publication called the Global Post had a reporter spend several months in Africa looking at the World Vision programs. The results were very troubling. They will not hire non-Christians for any full-time job, and in fact, when they hire Muslims or Hindus for menial part-time jobs, those folks get fired whenever a Christian comes around seeking to replace them. Fabio France, a World Vision director, doesn't think this should be seen as a big deal. Quoting Mr. France, we're very clear from the beginning about hiring Christians. It's not a surprise, so it's not discrimination. Yes, it is. In fact, this group received $281 million in grants In 2008 alone, near the end of the Bush administration, it demanded and received a letter from the Department of Justice interpreting federal law to officially sanction this kind of discrimination, even though no court has ever approved such an arrangement for anyone. So all employees there must now sign a Christian belief statement that includes a profession that the Bible is the inspired, the only infallible word of God. This council making these recommendations also has the president of Catholic Charities, the general counsel for the U.S. Catholic Conference. These are also organizations that receive vast amounts of money from your tax dollars. Catholic Charities got at least $521 million over the past decade. The Catholic bishops corralled at least $305 million. How do they vote on matters of interest to the council, matters of constitutional law? Well, all of these people have in recent weeks voted not to require any recipient of tax dollars to remove any religious icons or sayings or symbols from the walls of the rooms in which federal grants are being administered, federal services provided, not even if it is feasible to do so. They have also voted not to require any organization that is religious and receives tax dollars from creating a separate organization to use the money, not even to require a separate bank account to run the tax dollars through, separate from what they collect, for example, from people in the pews. This is an open invitation to lack of transparency, an open invitation to fraud. Now, you may find this a bit odd because you know that President Obama has said as recently as his State of the Union address that he doesn't want to see lobbyists run the government. And in fact, he's barred the participation of all lobbyists from all federal advisory commissions. That is to say, all federal advisory commissions apparently except his own. Many of the people sitting on his council making their rules, or at least recommending rules for themselves, are people who would, under any reasonable explanation of what a lobbyist is, would be included. However, guess what? They're exempted from registering as lobbyists, surprise, surprise, precisely because they are workers for religious organizations. So religious lobbyists aren't really lobbyists. Therefore, they don't need to register as lobbyists. Therefore, they can be appointed to advisory commissions at the White House. Therefore, they can make decisions that benefit their organizations, not just ideologically, but where they can benefit them financially. This is an outrage. This needs to be stopped. And any report that you see mentioned in newspapers over the next few weeks about reports to the president from his 25-member task force should be taken with a grain of salt. Let me change that. How about a grain of salt and a few extra salt shakers? We'll be back to talk about another controversy on the part of the religious right in the news when we return on Culture Shocks. I'm Barry Lynn. All right, and welcome back to Culture Shocks. We're talking today about a whole variety of church-state separation issues, really core questions about what the meaning of the Constitution is. We talked to Niels Nielsen earlier in the hour, and here is another issue that really bothers me. It's an issue where the religious right, in particular, wants to create a very fanciful interpretation of the First Amendment and is trying to argue that it has the right, even when a religious organization, and that includes a local church, is a tax-exempt entity on something called 501c3 of the Internal Revenue Code, if you want to look it up, that they should have the right to endorse candidates, even having the pastor of the church endorse candidates from the pulpit. Back in 1954, then-Senator from Texas Lyndon Johnson got an amendment added to the tax code which prohibited any charitable group, including religious ones, from using their tax-exempt income for partisan purposes in favor of or in opposition to particular candidates. The matter was quite non-controversial back then, and it's still seen that way today by most Americans, at least most Americans in public opinion polling. Federal tax law today is, if you want to make a reference to a fairy tale, kind of like the baby bear's porridge of fairy tale fame. It's just right when it comes to pastors speaking out on moral issues. There's nothing in the law that prohibits any religious leader from offering his or her opinion on the great moral questions of the day. On either side of the debate on contentious matters like military policy, abortion, gay marriage, or a panoply of other issues. What the law makes clear is merely that the resources of the church cannot be used to promote or oppose specific candidates for any public office. Now, most pastors understand and accept this dividing line. The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King spoke in a place of worship nearly every day of his adult life. He took on the issues of civil rights and peacemaking, but he never once endorsed a candidate from the pulpit. Why? Because he believed this to be the function of other community institutions, not the church. President John Kennedy, too, saw that the underlying principle of the separation of church and state required that, as he put it, no Catholic prelate would tell the president how to act, and no Protestant minister would tell his congregation for whom to vote. Well, notwithstanding this prohibition against candidate endorsement, pulpit freedom is alive and well in this country. Unless you've been living in a cave for the past several decades, it's pretty obvious that right-wing, left-wing, liberal, conservative, pastors of all kinds have no trouble injecting their moral and theological views into public discourse. Both the late Reverend Jerry Falwell and the retired Reverend Jeremiah Wright became well known for their controversial positions. There's a dizzying level of religious freedom of discourse in our country. Churches and other religious entities at all levels routinely use what they call their prophetic voice to try to change or to solidify public opinion. So when the religious right says there's been a chill on America's churches, that's a very fiery red herring that's been unrefrigerated far too long. Tax exemption for churches, by the way, is a privilege. It's not a right. The decision to grant such a privilege was made early in our history, but the Constitution doesn't mandate it. So it's perfectly reasonable for the Congress to say that in exchange for the valuable benefit of tax exemption, churches must play by certain rules and accept a certain level of oversight. To allow religious bodies to do whatever they would want gives them a special right accorded to no other entity. If we start exempting the church from the nonpartisanship rule, if pastors start endorsing candidates from the pulpit, why not just make the argument that they should be exempted from every other kind of report, every kind of disclosure, every kind of requirement? Maybe religious groups shouldn't even be required to have a public purpose. They can just collect money for the self-benefit of the pastor and his family. If there is to be separate treatment for religious entities, once you start down the slippery slope, you end up at the bottom very quickly. The restrictions that we're talking about are very, very modest. Writing legislation's always an exercise in drawing lines. The Internal Revenue Service now has the authority to distinguish partisanship from just general chit-chat or advocacy about the issues. The Internal Revenue Service, it's no one's favorite bureaucracy, we know that, but it's issued quite clear regulations and examples of the many activities which promote good citizenship and don't result in the unlawful endorsement of candidates, as well as noting what actions are indeed unlawful. Bluntly, almost all pastors need to do is to ask themselves in determining whether they could be on the verge of violating tax law from the pulpit is, am I about to say something from right up here in front of my congregation which is designed to promote the election or defeat of a candidate? If the answer they hear back in their head is yes, then they shouldn't say it. On the other hand, any church that wants an absolute right to speak out for or against specific candidates, they can use their pulpit at the Little Brown Church in the Vale or the mega platform of a multi-million dollar televised ministry by simply refusing to take a federal tax exemption. A few churches actually do that. Other pastors avail themselves of another option, creating an actual political action committee with private funds to express their opinion on the qualifications of candidates. It's a pretty rare thing for complaints about sermons to reach the Internal Revenue Service. Very few complaints are filed in any given election cycle. And frankly, most ministers are reticent at talking about issues at all, much less telling their congregations who to vote for on the school board or in a presidential campaign. Why? Because they fear the backlash from congregants, not because of any chilling effect of the Internal Revenue Service. Frankly, looking at these issues over the years, I'd say, if anything, the IRS is cutting too much slack for religious groups, a class of entities already protected by many other laws. It's not that they are giving them too much grief. It's that they're excusing too much. I once reported a pastor to the IRS who preached a 4th of July sermon back in 2004 in which he made negative comments about, quote, one candidate, as he phrased it, for the presidency. And as he spoke, a large, unflattering picture of John Kerry appeared on giant video screens. The pastor then went on to make very glowing remarks about another candidate, prompting a video display of the official White House photo of then-president and candidate George W. Bush. The two of us appeared on Fox News. That would be the pastor and myself, not the president and myself. He said, "I've done nothing wrong because I didn't mention any names. I just said one candidate and another." I think I asked him if he ever heard the old saying, "A picture is worth a thousand words." Well, the pastor, on those circumstances, apparently found that the IRS left him off the hook. Assuming he's telling the truth, tax laws are such that they prevent the public from knowing the disposition of these complaints, then I'd say the tax folks were passing on a clear violation. I don't think it does any good for the churches of this country to put themselves in a position of even wanting to endorse and oppose candidates. Think of it this way. If that were the case, candidates would immediately go to churches to seek their endorsement. There would be an effort to corrupt the integrity of the church and the integrity of the church's mission, which is to do, in its best work, the public good, not to engage itself in private partisan activity. The adoption of support for one faction in our political system over another. Let the church be the church. Let the church talk about moral issues. But please, let's not change the tax laws, as the religious right would suggest, to allow and specifically mandate the possibility that churches and other religious institutions can both keep their tax exemption and waltz merrily into the position of becoming a cog in some candidate's political machine. Call me conservative, but I don't mind smelling a little incense when I walk into the church, any church. I just as soon not smell cigar smoke coming from some back room where a candidate is making a deal with the pastor. I'm Barry Lynn, and we'll talk again.
This edition of Culture Shocks has been produced by Diane Robinson, engineered by Dwayne Davis, and the Genesis Communication Network technical staff. Visit us online at cultureshocks.com.